Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're taking a journey into the historical geography of ancient Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating topic.
It really is. And we're pulling our insights today from a brilliant lecture series by Dr. Perry Phillips. Our mission today is to, look right past the famous gold domes and the ancient monuments.
Right, the stuff you usually see on a postcard.
Exactly. We want to look past all that and instead uncover the hidden forces. We're talking about the valleys, the underground springs, the bedrock itself, the stuff that actually wrote the script for the history of this iconic city.
Yeah, and before we jump in, a quick note for you listening. The sources we're working with today, they pull from historical and religious texts, including biblical narratives.
Important to clarify.
Right. We are exploring these events strictly as they are presented in the texts and in Dr. Phillips's lecture. We're basically putting on our geographer hats to analyze the physical landscape and, how it dictated human movement.
Yeah, we aren't taking any theological or political sides here. We're just here to map out the incredible history as it's recorded.
Exactly. It's an objective look at the dirt and the stone.
Right. So think about this. If you were going to build an impenetrable ancient fortress to protect your civilization, you'd probably look for the highest mountain peak around.
Naturally,
Yeah.
yeah. Somewhere you could look down on your enemies.
Exactly. Well, the original founders of the most fought-over city in human history, they did the exact opposite.
Which is wild to think about.
It makes no sense at first. They built their fortress at the bottom of a geographic bowl, completely surrounded by enemies who would automatically have the high ground. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with the absolute most baffling real estate decision I've ever seen.
You're talking about the original settlement, known as the Jebusite City, or the Ophel, which later becomes the City of David.
Right.
When you look at a topographical map, the original city is nestled on this much lower hill,
Yeah.
flanked by incredibly steep valleys. You got the Kidron Valley to the east, the Hinnom Valley wrapping around the west and south, and then a central valley cutting right through the middle, which is wonderfully called the Terrapien, or the Valley of the Cheesemakers.
The Valley of the Cheesemakers. I love that. But this placement creates a scenario where the Mount of Olives and the Temple Mount literally tower over the original city.
Yeah, they just completely shadow it.
There's that famous line in Psalm 121 that says, "I lift my eyes unto the hills." We usually read that as, I don't know, a beautiful spiritual metaphor about looking to heaven.
Right, a very poetic image.
But when you actually stand in the original city of David, you are quite literally craning your neck, looking up at the hills surrounding you on all sides.
Because you're in the bottom of the bowl.
Wait, if you are building a fortress to protect yourself from invading armies, why on earth would you put yourself in a position where your enemies can just stand on the higher hills and rain arrows down on you? Tactically, I mean, it sounds like a nightmare.
It does. But what's fascinating here is the brutal calculus of ancient survival.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you can have the highest, thickest, most impenetrable walls in the world. But if you don't have water inside those walls,
Right. Water.
yeah, a besieging army doesn't even need to attack you. They just set up camp, wait a few weeks, and you literally just surrender from dehydration. The original city was placed in that vulnerable bowl for one singular reason, and that is the Gihon Spring.
So water is the ultimate trump card.
Always. The Gihon Spring sits down in the Kidron Valley. So ancient city planning was this incredibly delicate, high-stakes balancing act.
How
You
so?
can't build your defensive wall all the way down to the very bottom of the valley, because then the enemy has the slope of the hill entirely on their side.
Right.
If your wall is at the bottom of a V shape, invaders could practically pole vault over your defenses.
Gravity would just do all the work for them.
Exactly. But you also can't build your wall too high up the hill, because then you leave the spring, which is, again, your only water source, completely exposed outside the city limits.
Okay, so they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. What did they do?
So they compromised. They built halfway up the slope. That compromise kept them safe from an easy breach, but it meant they had to become absolute master engineers to access their water without getting killed.
Which explains the insane lengths they went to. The Jebusites, the original inhabitants, they built a massive pool to collect the water, but they accessed it through a heavily protected rock-cut tunnel with steps.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
You could stay safely inside the fortified city, walk down this dark, carved tunnel, fill your jars at the pool, and walk back up.
And we should actually pause here and clarify a pretty famous archaeological myth. related to this.
Oh, about Warren's shaft.
Yeah, exactly. For a long time, historians thought an underground feature discovered there, called Warren's shaft, was used like a vertical well.
Oh, right, like dropping a bucket down.
Right. The theory was that citizens would stand at the top and drop buckets down on ropes to haul up water. But recent geology and archaeology, they've proven it's actually just a natural sinkhole.
Wait, really? Just a sinkhole?
Yeah. There isn't a single rope friction mark anywhere on the limestone walls.
Wow. So no dropping buckets. But, I mean, what they did do later on makes dropping a bucket look like child's play.
Oh, without a doubt.
Let's talk about King Hezekiah's tunnel. The year is 701 BC. The Assyrian army, this massive, terrifying superpower, is marching to lay siege to Jerusalem.
A truly terrifying prospect for anyone at the time.
Yeah. And King Hezekiah knows that if the Assyrians find the Gihon Spring flowing freely outside the walls, two terrible things happen.
Right.
One, the enemy has plenty of water to sustain a siege for months. Two, they can easily dam it up and cut off the city's supply. Your greatest asset instantly becomes your fatal flaw.
So Hezekiah makes a desperate, brilliant decision. He orders his workers to completely seal up the outside spring and divert the water entirely.
By carving a tunnel straight through solid bedrock.
Exactly. The goal is to channel the spring water to the Pool of Siloam, which sits safely inside the city walls. This tunnel is almost a half mile long, and it's 150 feet underground.
That's just wild.
And the craziest part, they dug it simultaneously from both ends.
Imagine the sheer terror and claustrophobia of this project. You are 150 feet deep inside a mountain of solid limestone.
Yeah, in the dark.
You don't have modern tunneling shields or ventilation. It's sweltering, the dust is choking you, and you're working by the dim light of oil lamps. You start on one side, a second team starts a half mile away.
Just swinging pickaxes.
Right. You have no compasses, no GPS, no surveying lasers. You are literally just swinging bronze pickaxes into solid rock, hoping you meet in the middle.
The mechanics of how they pulled this off are still mind-boggling to geologists today. They didn't just dig blindly, though.
How did they know where to go?
Geologists now believe they expertly followed natural karstic fissures. Basically, these are tiny pre-existing cracks in the limestone where water had already started to erode the rock.
Okay, so they followed the water's path.
Yes, and they were using the acoustics of the mountain itself. By following these natural acoustic channels, they could actually hear the faint tapping of the other team's pickaxes through the stone.
That's incredible.
And they basically just steered toward the sound.
And we know they actually pulled it off because archaeologists found an inscription carved into the tunnel wall exactly where the two teams met.
The Siloam inscription?
Yeah. It describes the thrilling moment they heard each other's voices through the rock and finally swung the last pickaxes to break through. Hezekiah literally weaponized the geography.
If he really did.
By pulling the water inside, he kept his people hydrated and starved the greatest army on earth of the water they needed to survive the harsh terrain outside the walls.
And securing the water allowed the city to survive the Assyrians. But surviving isn't what made Jerusalem the political powerhouse it eventually became.
Right. Survival is just step one.
That transition comes down to its precise location on a map. When King David captures the city from the Jebusites, famously sneaking his troops in through that very water system, by the way, he doesn't just treat it as another fortress.
No, he makes a massive political move.
He moves his entire capital there from the southern city of Hebron.
I love the analogy Dr. Phillips uses in the source material for this. Moving the capital to Jerusalem was the exact same logic the United States used when creating Washington, D.C.
It's a great comparison.
After the American Revolution, George Washington didn't put the capital in New York or Boston, which would have alienated the South.
Right.
And he didn't put it in Charleston, which would have alienated the North. They basically carved out a brand new swamp right on the border of Maryland and Virginia to force the northern and southern states into a union. David was doing the exact same thing 3,000 years earlier.
It's a masterclass in neutral territory. If we connect this to the bigger picture, before capturing Jerusalem, David was ruling from Hebron, which was deep in the territory of his own tribe, Judah.
Right, he was on home turf.
But he was trying to forge a united kingdom that included the powerful northern tribes, like Ephraim and Manasseh. If he stays in Hebron, the northern tribes think he's playing favorites.
Makes sense.
By relocating to Jerusalem, which sat precisely on the border between Judah in the south and the northern tribes, he essentially neutralized the regional jealousy.
But, placing your unifying capital on a highly defensible, steep ridge surrounded by deep valleys creates a ticking time bomb, which is population growth.
Oh, absolutely. You run out of flat land incredibly fast.
The source describes Jerusalem at this time as the compact city. Space on the Ophel was so premium that they literally had to stack the buildings on top of each other.
They had to get creative.
They used massive amounts of fill dirt and stones, an architectural feature called the Millo, to build these huge terraced foundations stepping up the side of the hill, literally just to create flat surfaces for houses.
And archaeology gives us a wonderfully clear picture of this daily life. Excavations uncovered a wealthy residence known as Akil's house.
I remember this from the lecture.
Yeah, it was a substantial two-story home built right onto these artificial terraces. And as a fascinating, slightly glamorous detail of ancient domestic life, they found the home's toilet still intact.
Oh, wow.
It's a horizontal stone block with a hole carved in it, roughly the size of a large modern laptop, just positioned over a cesspit.
It's the small details, like a laptop-sized stone toilet, that make history feel real. But, the way these houses were terraced, stepping up the steep hillside, had massive narrative consequences.
It really did.
Dr. Phillips points out how this compact geography draws a direct line to the famous biblical story of King David and Bathsheba.
The topography perfectly sets the stage for the human drama. Because the city is built on steep terraces, the roof of a house on a lower terrace is perfectly unavoidably visible from the roof of a house on a higher terrace.
So in the biblical text says David was walking on the roof of his palace, which was naturally built at the very highest point of the city, and he looks down and sees Bathsheba bathing on her roof. It's not some contrived plot device.
Not at all.
It's a literal fact of the local geography. The way the terraces were stacked, he physically couldn't avoid looking directly down onto the domestic spaces of his neighbors.
The geography literally dictated the lines of sight, which sparked the events that followed. But of course, you can only build so many terraces.
Right. You eventually run out of room entirely.
As the centuries rolled on, the population swelled, and adapting to the mountain was no longer enough. By the time the Romans arrive, the leaders of Jerusalem realize they can't just mold their city around the topography anymore. They have to completely erase the topography.
Enter the mega projects.
Yes, the massive landscape-altering builds.
King Solomon had already expanded the city north onto Mount Moriah to build the first temple, but things reached a completely different, almost psychotic stratosphere of engineering centuries later with King Herod the Great.
Herod did not do things small.
No, he did not. Herod looks at this rounded, natural mountain and decides, I don't want a mountain. I want a perfectly flat, massive rectangle. And so he builds the largest temple mount in classical antiquity.
To achieve that flat surface on a naturally rounded peak, Herod's engineers had to construct colossal retaining walls all around the mountain.
Right.
Then they filled the cavernous gaps between the walls and the mountain with dirt and intricate stone arches to create a massive elevated platform.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The stones they used for these retaining walls weren't just big, they were titanic.
Huge.
Dr. Phillips details how these were perfectly chiseled ashlar stones. And for those wondering, an ashlar stone means it isn't just a rough boulder pulled from a field.
No, it's very precise.
Right. It is a massive block of limestone carved into an absolutely flawless, smooth rectangle. They fit together so perfectly that even today, 2,000 years later, you cannot slide a single razor blade between the cracks.
And they didn't use mortar.
No, they didn't use a drop of mortar. It's just pure friction and gravity holding them together. And the largest of these foundation stones, get this, it is 40 feet long and weighs 570 tons.
To put 570 tons in perspective, that is roughly the combined weight of two fully loaded Boeing 777 airplanes.
Two airplanes.
Moved and placed with razor-thin precision in the year 22 BC. They didn't have diesel cranes.
How did they even do it?
The mechanics involved thousands of laborers, complex pulley systems, massive wooden rollers to reduce friction, and carefully constructed earthen ramps. Oxen and men hauled these blocks inch by inch. It was just a triumph of brute force and sophisticated physics.
Man, it makes my back hurt just thinking about the sheer human calories burned to move one of those blocks.
Yeah, the labor is unimaginable.
But, what goes up must come down. The source details how this incredible Herodian architecture met its tragic end in 70 AD when the Roman Empire besieged and systematically destroyed the city.
And the geography of that destruction is literally frozen in time today.
I love this part.
When you excavate the ancient Roman street at the base of the Temple Mount today, you find it completely smashed. The heavy paving stones of the street are deeply cracked, cratered, and caved in.
Like a meteor hit it.
Exactly. And lying right there in the rubble are the massive ashlar blocks from Herod's wall. The Roman soldiers actually levered those huge stones off the top of the retaining wall and sent them plummeting hundreds of feet, smashing the street below.
It's like finding a crime scene photo from 2 millennia ago left perfectly undisturbed. Archaeologists even found one specific block in that rubble with a Hebrew inscription carved into it reading, "To the place of trumpeting."
Oh, the trumpeting stone.
Yeah. It had fallen and landed exactly where ancient historical texts said a priest would stand at the very top corner of the wall to blow a trumpet, signaling the start of the religious festivals.
This Herodian landscape, these massive walls, the specific pools and architectural anomalies, it set the physical stage for the events of the New Testament.
Right.
What modern archaeology is doing now is basically ground-truthing those ancient texts. They're digging up the dirt and proving just how highly accurate the geographical descriptions in those stories really are.
The details are stunning, honestly. Take the Pool of Bethesda. For centuries, scholars read the Gospel of John, which mentions a pool with 5 porticos.
And a portico is just a covered walkway.
Right, a colonnade supported by stone columns. So historians scratch their heads for a long time. A standard pool is rectangular, right? It has 4 sides. How do you have 5 covered walkways?
It didn't make structural sense.
Exactly. Many scholars assume the author was just using a clumsy metaphor, but then archaeologists actually excavated the site.
And they found a massive rectangular pool with 4 colonnades running around the outside perimeter and a 5th colonnade built right on a partition wall cutting straight through the middle, dividing the pool in 2.
The author of the text wasn't inventing a spiritual metaphor. They were just accurately reporting the bizarre, specific local architecture of a real place in Jerusalem.
It's that kind of detail that makes history leap off the page.
But my absolute favorite example of this ground truthing is the story of the blind man at the Pool of Siloam. The biblical text says Jesus encounters a man blind from birth up near the Temple Mount. He puts mud on the man's eyes and tells him to go wash it off in the Pool of Siloam. Reading that on a flat page, it sounds like a quick, casual stroll down the block to a neighborhood fountain.
But when you look at the topographical map of Jerusalem we've been building in our minds,
mm-hmm.
you realize what a monumental, exhausting task that actually was.
Put yourself in this man's shoes for a second. The Temple Mount is at the very highest point of the city. The Pool of Siloam, where Hezekiah's underground tunnel emptied out, is at the very bottom of the Tyropian Valley.
That's a huge distance.
That is a half-mile journey through a crowded, bustling, terraced, ancient city. And it's not a flat walk. It is a massive 450-foot drop in elevation.
Wow.
That is the equivalent of walking down 45 flights of stairs. And this man is doing it completely blind, navigating uneven ancient stone steps. People are bumping into him, animals are in the streets, and he's got thick mud caked onto his eyelids.
The sensory experience of that walk must have been absolutely terrifying.
Right. So what does this all mean? Why send him on this treacherous downward hike?
This raises an important question. And in ancient texts, geography is almost always paired with theology. Dr. Phillips points out the profound symbolism embedded in this specific topographical journey.
The name Siloam, right?
Yeah. The name Siloam translates from Hebrew to mean sent. The text is drawing a deliberate physical parallel.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Just as Jesus was understood by his followers to be sent, descending from heaven to earth, the blind man must physically descend 450 feet from the towering Holy Temple Mount down into the valley to the Pool of the Sent in order to receive his sight.
The physical descent down the bedrock perfectly mirrors the spiritual narrative.
Exactly. You cannot separate the story from the soil it happens on. Every step of that narrative is dictated by the steep slope of the mountain.
That's just incredible. We started this deep dive down in a vulnerable valley, looking at a hidden spring that dictated where the very first walls could be built.
We watched inhabitants tunnel through solid limestone in pitch darkness just to survive an empire.
We saw King David use a map to unite a fractured nation. And we ended looking at 570-ton stones and a 450-foot blind descent that gave physical weight to an ancient text.
It really completely changes how you look at history. It isn't just dates, kings, and treaties. History is water, rock, and gravity.
Yeah.
The next time you're reading a historical account or honestly, even watching the modern news about a geopolitical conflict, I highly recommend opening up a topographic map. the mountains, the rivers, and the valleys. They are the silent authors writing the script for human events.
Which leaves us with something really fascinating to chew on. We started this conversation by talking about how we build cities today.
Right.
We bring in the bulldozers, we pour the concrete, and we use dynamite to bend geography to our will. We pave over the valleys and flatten the mountains to force our grid onto the landscape.
We force the land to adapt to us.
Exactly. But looking at the delicate balance of ancient Jerusalem, a city that survived precisely because it intimately understood its own limestone bedrock and water tables, it makes you wonder. When a modern city completely ignores its natural landscape, forcing the earth to adapt to us instead of us adapting to it, what long-term vulnerabilities are we secretly building into our own future?
That's a really sobering thought to leave on.
It is. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. We'll catch you next time.